Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we have an interview that we did last night on our FM show in Lakeville, Connecticut, Q103, with Larry Dorman. Larry is the Public Affairs Coordinator of the AFSCME Union. He's going to talk about the state of several of the initiatives that the union was interested in, and in some local politics. We're having a governor's race here in Connecticut. He's going to talk about that. So that'll be about 8:30. And before that, we'll share some news with you. We had some things that we copied from last night, some interesting news. This is from uruknet.info. It's about Clinton, who is coordinating the Haiti relief. Ban Ki-moon obviously has a very twisted sense of humor. As if the Katrina fiasco wasn't sufficient evidence of the singular unsuitability of the U.S. to lead any sort of disaster effort, appointing a power-abusing, sex-offending, lying ex-president as a special envoy begged belief. Even the most generous interpretation would have to include that the U.S. had already surpassed its Katrina incompetence. They took 8 days, yes, 8 days, to decide to airdrop food and water into Haiti, resulting in who knows how many thousands of unnecessary deaths. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said earlier airdrops ruled out because they might have done more harm than good. That's an interesting thought, but I didn't think they could, possibly. There would be more survivors who might challenge the blatant U.S. military occupation carried out under the guise of security to protect the populace from the pseudo-rioting and looting invented by the U.S. media hacks to justify it. But more of the ungenerous interpretation later. When the U.S. finally got around to airdrops, that is when the riots and looting were happening, anyway, because so little assistance was forthcoming and some ethical international commentators were having more success getting the truth out than Fox and all their ilk. We learned the purported why of the delay. Parachuting bundles of food and water into Haiti became viable for the first time Monday in big part because there are enough troops there to identify the safe place to drop them. How ridiculous. Give us a break. Before the earthquake even struck, the UN already had over 10,000 troops, both and other personnel and international police on the ground in Haiti, and there were some 10,000 NGOs registered. Are we seriously expected to believe that these guys couldn't get it together to receive airdrops? Worse still, the headquarters of the U.S. Southern Command held pre-disaster simulations in Miami of a relief response to the impact of a hurricane in Haiti the day before the earthquake. Are there memories that short? It's therefore pretty obvious that both the UN and the U.S. military, not to mention a sizable bunch of NGOs, aren't up to the job of looking after disaster victims' interests. What is left obvious is why the UN does not head up the response effort by someone from a country with a proven track record in this, such as Cuba, together with someone from UNICEF, given the age of demographic of Haiti. Maybe because the real reason it took 8 days for the U.S. administration to start a genuine emergency response is that, with the complicity of Ban Ki-moon and the puppet president, Prevail, they were too busy using the earthquake as a convenient excuse to secure U.S. interests in the region. They were too busy taking military control of Haiti's airports and port facilities, prioritizing the deployment of U.S. troops, evacuation of U.S. citizens, to trouble themselves with such trivial details as the provision and distribution of food and medical supplies to the devastated Haitians. How many thousands more Haitians would have died but for the Cuban doctors who had continuously and without fanfare been providing emergency health care from day one and from Venezuela from day two after they had managed to circumvent the U.S. military blockade of the airport. More concerned about appearing to lead the world and upstaging Cuba and Venezuela in the public relations stakes, the U.S. prevented not only CARICOM and countries from landing with humanitarian assistance, but also flights from France, Brazil, and Italy, as well as several international aid agencies such as UNICEF, World Food Program, Médecins Sans Frontières, and the Red Cross, who were either refused landing or diverted to other countries in the essential first days. And it's not only one way. The U.S. is also running a naval blockade to keep adult Haitians from getting out. There are increasing suspicions that the U.S. may even have caused the earthquake. The result of this barefaced U.S. military invasion masquerading as aid was a veritable chorus of well-founded accusations from international diplomatic, media, academic, legal, human rights, and political circles that the U.S., with the complicity of the United Nations, was using the Haitian earthquake to undertake a military occupation of Haiti to further U.S. strategic, military, and economic interests in the region. Aid finally started, aid finally started reaching people, but that was not the only thing to arrive. In scenes reminiscent of the 2004 tsunami, where thousands of child survivors just disappeared into the people trafficking ether, human vultures had already swooped, stealing children from hospitals and scooping up orphans by the plane and busload and transporting them out of Haiti. UNICEF said that the disaster was likely to have separated thousands of children from their parents or guardians, and the agency repeated warnings about the threat of child traffickers. In an attempt to prevent the illegal departure of many children, UNICEF is deploying two specialized staff to control documentation in the airports. Let's see. We should hardly be surprised, even a human rights law quoting suitable outrage, usually on the button U.S. commentator, neglected to mention that the U.S. is one of only two countries in the world not to have ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Why should they suddenly start caring about Haitian children when they don't even pretend to protect their own? And in Clinton's case, have sex with at least one woman in his employ young enough to be his daughter. Isn't that precisely one of the major problems already facing Restivix? Given the U.S. conduct since the Haiti quake, and Bill Clinton's before and since, I think we can safely say that in condoning the U.S. military occupation of Haiti and appointing Bill Clinton as the UN Special Envoy, Ban Ki-moon demonstrated a gross lack of respect and concern, not only for Haitians, but for every member country of the organization and several of its own agencies to boot. Clinton's illness provides him with an opportunity to make at least some amends. I don't understand that. As Chodorkovsky and numerous others have pointed out since the devastation of 12th of January, the Haitian people have exhibited a high degree of solidarity, courage, and social commitment. Social commitment, which the militarization of relief operations can only undermine, weakening the organizational capabilities of Haitians to rebuild and reinstate their institutions of civilian government as well as their lives. Community-based integrated disaster response and recovery models have been promoted by various UN bodies and at-risk countries for at least the last decade. It's time Ban Ki-moon walked the talk. He should be supporting UN agencies in their difficult task of using best practice to assist Haitians to rebuild their shattered lives, not undermining them by condoning a military occupation and genocide. He should now appoint the most appropriate person as special envoy for the response and recovery effort, a person with demonstrated capacity in the area without exploitive economic motives, but with the trust and confidence of Haitians. This is clearly not Bill Clinton, whose current health crisis supports it's time to give him a break and appoint a new person in this important role.
Okay.
So that's an interesting perspective.
Yeah.
Not one at all that our press has given. So
we
I not
want to touch on
quite
this
love
tonight,
the way we think we are. I can't see that. The printing's too small.
You want to read this one? And this one, you want to go through this one, or I can read that one?
Yeah, I can't even see it.
Okay. Did you want to look at that one? That was,
Well, why don't you just read that, Leo?
Okay. Israel bombs Gaza agricultural sector to the brink. This is put out by politicaltheatrics.net. If we didn't get the wheat planted today, we would have had the crops. We wouldn't have, would not have had the crops this year, says Abu Salih Abu Tiana, eyeing the two Israeli military jeeps parked along the border fence east of Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip. Although this land is more than 300 meters away, technically outside the Israeli-imposed buffer zone, Abu Tamaya has reason to worry, to be wary. He shot at us yesterday. I was here with my wife and nephews. Like many farmers along Gaza's eastern and northern borders, Abu Tamaya has been delayed planting by the absence of water and the threat from Israeli soldiers along the border. With most of Gaza border well region wells, cisterns, and water lines destroyed by Israeli forces during last winter's attacks, farmers have been largely left with no option but to wait for heavier rains. There's more here. I just got to turn the page. Israeli soldiers started intensively bulldozing the land in 2003. Hang on one second here, I'm sorry.
You'd probably be better to be able to see that online.
No, I can read it. I was trying to multitask. And I can't.
We had some very small printing on some of our articles here.
But they finished the job, the last war in Gaza, after Tamara, owner of 30 acres, approximately 1,000 square meters, dangerously close to the buffer zone. I was going to read this, but
What's happening? Let me explain what's happening.
Yeah.
What's happening is there's a zone right near Israel.
But it's so long. I mean, the article is so long.
Yeah. Well, what's happening is Israel's decided that this zone the Palestinians can't step on.
Right.
So they shoot them and kill them. But the problem is that zone that they've decided they can't step on is their agricultural zone.
It's their land.
It's where they raised all their olive groves, where they had cattle, and where they raised wheat and lemons and all kinds of things. And the Israelis have decided they can't be there. And so if they go there, they kill them. They've destroyed all their wells, they've destroyed their farms, they've just destroyed everything that the Palestinians had. Now they can't feed themselves.
Yeah, and it's a complete and utter genocide, and nobody is doing squat about it.
Huh.
It's just infuriating, and nobody's listening to it. You don't see anything, not a word spoken about in the mainstream media, not whatsoever, all right? And, I mean, Palestine might well as not even exist, okay?
Well, that's what they intend
for. That's right. So it's like, you know, and Iraq might as well not exist. Nobody's talking about Iraq, even though we're still losing lives by the hundreds over there, you know, every month. So it's like the whole thing is one big absurd cover-up, folks. And, you know, this Gaza mess is really serious. And, I don't know, do as much as you can, read as much as you can about it, become aware of it. And, you know, politicaltheatrics.net, go to that site and check that out. It's a long article, but it's an informative one. And I don't know what else to tell you. Just look up, you know, stay tuned here. We try to bring some information every week to you, you know, on this issue, and you know, update you on what's going on. And it's just a futile. It almost seems futile sometimes, but I, you know, the Palestinian people.
I don't know
need
how
help,
they're not
they need
discouraged.
Help.
God,
they're
poor people. They're going to have no food. Their water.
There's another thing I got. I was going to bring it up today, and I was very upset when I read it too. But on my Facebook group, I have the Indians, the Lakota Indians, were trying to
Lakota Sioux.
The Lakota Sioux, yeah. And they were one lady there. Autumn Two Bulls, I believe is her name, and she's been raising funds for that reservation. People are calling her constantly in need. These poor Indian people are just, you know, starving. They're actually the American people that don't have enough money to keep their electricity going. They don't have in their houses or fuel or food on the table or anything. And the government's cut back on all kinds of programs for them. And it's just and there's no industry. There's no nothing for them. Indian reservations. It's not just the Lakota. It's so many of the American Indian reservations, and that in itself is an ongoing genocide. And you know,
we took their culture away from them by forcing their children to go to schools.
They took their religion away from them
and their language.
Yeah, exactly, and their language and their culture. And took their livelihood away from them and threw them on reservations and fed them poisoned food.
Oh, God.
Horrible. Just horrible. So, you know, she got behind the... Our cat just got behind the desk there and scratching. But she enjoys doing that to annoy us. And, but that... you know, it's a tragic thing. It's a tragic thing that's going on, not just in the United States, but... in Gaza and Palestine, but right here in our own country, it's absolutely. But you know, to say our system of genocide is the system used by the Israelis, and the system is used by the ethnic cleansing.
Well,
we were
taught by the Western Europeans.
That's right. And
we learned that lesson well.
I mean, we enslaved. We enslaved the blacks. We had indentured slaves over here from the beginning. People that virtually sold their soul to get out of Europe and start a new life, but became indebted for years to
indentured service.
To indentured service, and so it's like, you know, people. It's been heartless all along. Till somebody has to wake up and do it, and somebody has to be the herald, if you will, and say, hey, it's time to wake up, you know. Let's not kill our people. Can't kill everybody on Earth here, you know.
Well, we seem to want to do that.
Somebody wants to do it. We don't, but, I mean, somebody definitely wants to do it. And they're working with it on the Palestinians, and they're doing it with the American Indians. They've been doing that for years. So we just hope that that these people wake up to what's really happening.
And wherever you live, in your state or your city or your town, there are probably people starving.
I'm sure
people
there are.
That don't have enough money to pay for their shelter or
can't
for
see
their
a doctor or can't you know they're you know, they're dying. Somebody said, I was listening to this, they had done a free clinic, medical clinic here in Connecticut, and I think it was in New Haven.
Hartford.
Was it Hartford?
Yeah.
And I think they did one in New Haven, too. And one day, and they had like several thousand people standing in line, and of course only about 1,000 people could get service. And people were all in critical condition. Critical condition, with heart problems and everything else, and they couldn't afford the medicines, they couldn't afford to see a doctor, Medicare, they didn't qualify for Medicare, they weren't 65 or
Well, that's
whatever.
Not free either.
No, but I mean they couldn't even qualify for it. So it's like,
oh,
you know, just people dying and struggling, people in their 20s and 30s and 40s. I mean, it's just horrible. And
they should feel really sad when you see things
and people
like
denying
that.
People denying them, denying insurance and everything. It's part of the genocide. It's part of the genocide. And if anybody wants to get more familiar with the methods of the government destroying you
and the globalist agenda,
Global 2000 report. It's right in Google, or it was not too long ago when I read it and copied it, and you know. Global 2000 report signed off by Jimmy Carter and instituted by Carter and signed off by Reagan on how to reduce the global population by 2/3 by the year 2050.
And folks, remember that one was a Democratic president, the other was a Republican.
Yeah, that's right.
They agree right at the top about all that
stuff. And those
stuff.
Policies have continued since, right? So the great humanitarian Yitzhak Jimmy Carter, all right, it was actually the guy who signed off with his globalist New World Order son of a bitch advisor Brzezinski.
Yep.
All right, and Kissinger. All right, these guys authorized this study. Okay, this report on global population reduction and what would happen by at certain years if the population didn't drastically reduced globally. 100 million people are slated for death in this country by the year 2020.
Because you're in the way, folks.
100 million.
They don't want you. You're in the way.
All right. So they're trying to do it with mass flu injection vaccines, phony vaccines. It'll kill
chemtrailing.
You. Chemtrailing, pollution in the water, fluoridation of the water. Just anything, everything possible, you know, is part of this thing. So, it's a horrendous nightmare. But anyway, why not? Can you read any of these? They're too small.
Take a look.
I just want to queue up this thing.
While you're queuing up, I'll
see if you can read that one on Monsanto.
On this, stop Monsanto's GMO contamination. During the Bush administration, Monsanto illegally won USDA approval for its genetically engineered GE alfalfa by convincing regulators to bypass a mandatory environmental review. In response to a lawsuit by consumer groups, the courts then stepped in and banned GE alfalfa until the USDA followed the law. In December, the USDA released its belated review of Monsanto's GE alfalfa seed and determined that Monsanto's alfalfa met the Obama administration standard despite the risk of organic contamination. Organic contamination is devastating for organic farmers, especially organic dairy farmers, most of whom use organic alfalfa for feed. The presence of even the smallest amount of GE material can cause a farm to lose its organic certification. And court documents indicate that early planting of GE alfalfa did contaminate conventional alfalfa, yet the USDA maintains that Monsanto's existing safety protocols are good enough. That's ridiculous. Even worse, the USDA concluded that the possibility of contamination of organic fields is of no concern since consumers don't care if their organic food or milk contains genetically engineered components. Yet central to the definition of the USDA organic label is the total absence of genetically modified ingredients. As overwhelmingly majority of consumers buy organic to avoid GE products and would be shocked to learn that the USDA is so cavalier about the risks of the transgenic contamination. So there you go, folks. They don't care about it at all. It's all about the money. That's all it's about. So we should have our interview ready any second now. I think Leo, is it queued up?
Yeah, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this out. So we read this last night. And
what's that? Our tape should be ready any minute.
I hope so.
Don't touch it. Just let it play. Hopefully it'll be ready.
Still, we're still working on this.
Go ahead. Let it play.
Yeah, this was a couple articles going into our interview with Larry, so we'll just play that out. It's best rather than try to cue it up.
Yeah.
It has its problems.
Yeah,
is that name, Zippy. EZIPI, coming out of this film. Zippy.
Yeah.
Zippy says she is willing to visit Britain despite the risk of her being arrested for war crimes against the Palestinians. The visit is meant to push the White Hall into changing a law which has occasioned an arrest warrant against her. A British court ruling last year convinced Lavini of links to atrocities committed by Israelis during Israel during its late December 2008 assault on Gaza Strip, which left more than 1,400 Palestinians dead, and a court issued her an arrest warrant which would come into effect should she visit Britain. Lavini said last night that she was willing to take the bullet, and Britain has obligated itself to me personally that this subject will be taken care of and fixed. Now is the time, the British newspaper The Times reported on Monday. London has downplayed the prospects of an arrest by apologizing to Tel Aviv and promising urgent legal adjustments. Isn't that typical?
Mm-hmm.
And any reversal would require amending the universal jurisdiction law, which allows individuals in Britain to ask courts of law to issue arrest warrants for any offenses, such as war crimes, committed abroad. And the Daily, however, doubted any swift change in the law, quoting Justice Secretary Jack Straw, suggesting that the sensitivity of the legal situation involved could require its postponement until after the country's elections. So, it's a hot button. But, I'm sorry, we'll change our whole constitution for you. We don't care. You can commit war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's how confident this Zippy is, you know.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, she's willing to go over there just to shove it in their face, you know. But anyway, I got to call Larry. I'll be right. We'll be back in a second. Go ahead, Larry, if you have anything.
Okay, I'll just mention the article. It's a little bit too long to read. Israel bombs Gaza agricultural sector to the brink. What's happened is that there's like a demilitarized zone between Gaza and Israel, and that whole zone is where all the agriculture for the Gaza Strip took place, and the Israelis destroyed all the wells, all the olive groves, all the possibility of farming there, and if you step a foot into that territory, you're shot or arrested. And you should go to the Israel bombs Gaza agricultural sector at www.politicaltheatrics.net, and you can read that article.
We got Larry Dorman on the line. So welcome to the show, Larry.
Leo,
hi, how are you?
Great to hear from you guys, I should say.
Yeah, well, we haven't talked to you in a while.
No, how you doing?
Oh, we're doing just great. We were wondering from you, though. We haven't heard too much about the healthcare program since the Olympics is on. It's like everything in the United States has stopped and all world news is non-existent.
Right, well, you know, it's obviously at best in a holding pattern.
Yeah.
And for obvious reasons, the election that brought Scott Brown to the Senate, more flux with Evan Bayh retiring, and so I don't really know where this thing is heading.
I think the thing that upset me, though, and even though I'm a union member and it benefit me, I really wasn't too pleased with the fact that union members were, it kind of divided union members from the rest of the working class and middle class by being
right.
exempt from that tax penalty. And I don't think that was good for the unions, personally.
No, and how do you think that played? I mean, how do you think that developed? I mean, that to me,
it's not good PR, Larry.
No, I think that the problem is that whole health care bill seems to be full of special benefits for different groups.
Right,
and I don't think that's a good thing.
A couple things that interested me, as a representative of AFSCME, and obviously we've been fighting for this initiative. We want to see it happen. The election in Massachusetts, the AFL-CIO did exit polling. And,
what'd they get from that?
Yeah, 46% of union members supported Scott Brown.
Oh, they did?
Wow.
And,
really
speaks volumes, I think, to the problems and to the fact that this whole thing is now stalled. There's a message there, obviously, that the Obama administration needs to heed about pushing for jobs. That was foremost on the minds of the several hundred union voters who were surveyed after that Massachusetts special election for the U.S. Senate. Jobs is the big issue. The excise tax that we discussed, I think, on the last program,
mm-hmm.
that was essentially a tax on insurance companies for high-end plans that offer the kinds of plans we negotiate for
right.
our members across the table for management. But clearly that excise tax would have been passed along to union members somehow, or to anybody with those high-end plans, because
yeah.
the insurance company either would have raised rates,
wouldn't they?
Employers would have cut benefits. So those are some of the lessons that kind of came out of the Massachusetts election.
What did the I wanted to ask you about that. What did they really like about that? What did people like about Scott Brown? What was his message?
Again, I can only speak to the AFL-CIO poll, and I'm
right.
not even convinced it was what they liked about Scott Brown. I think
mm-hmm.
it was a sense that the Obama administration isn't focusing with enough precision and intensity on job creation.
Mm-hmm.
Stimulating the economy.
And also, Massachusetts has a health care system already that was really better than the one that was going to be offered by the federal government.
And again, I think that, and I'm not saying it's valid or it's right or it's accurate, entirely accurate, but the issue of the excise tax is focusing clearly on that. It was very... very, very hurtful to the cause, and you already see some of the after effects that we're going to have to live with, because last week the Senate essentially under threat of filibuster
mm-hmm.
was able to force the Obama administration to back off at least temporarily on its nominee to fill a vacancy at the National Labor Relations Board. And that's a really destructive thing. This is a lawyer, Craig Becker, and the NLRB has been very tilted in favor of employers. Under Bush, they issued zero rulings actually in favor of workers.
Right.
This guy's nomination essentially was tabled under threat of filibuster, and then that shows you the impact of having Scott Brown in the Senate. So,
do you think they'll appoint him during like a recess?
Yes,
appointment.
He has the ability to do that.
Yeah.
Whether they do that.
But what didn't they like about this guy? About Obama's appointment for labor?
It had nothing to do with anything other than the fact that they could do this.
Oh.
If you follow
me.
Yeah.
It's really, obviously, they were saying that he was too biased toward labor. He is. As a labor attorney has represented workers and unions. But again, this is all about balance. That board has been amazingly unbalanced over the years under Bush. So,
I forgot her name, but what about the lady who's the Secretary of Labor now?
Right. I mean, she's been great.
She's done a lot of work, done well for you so far?
Yeah. But, again, I'm getting back to your question about what came out, I don't want to overstate things in terms of the Massachusetts special election, but it was only, it was about a month ago, I think, actually, tonight, it was the January 19th, and I think that they surveyed 810 union members in the special election,
mm-hmm.
and Brown scored very high among union members, and I think that it's being treated sort of as a working class revolt that, you know, Democrats haven't been successfully addressing the economic concerns articulated by union members and other workers. And, you know, the goals haven't changed from the November 2008 election, but voters clearly don't see, you know, the job getting done. And interesting, I'm looking at some of the breakouts of the poll right now as I speak to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Brown, with no record, no ability to demonstrate that he's done anything, clearly benefited from economic dissatisfaction. Now, this was a poll conducted by the Hart Research Associates, which is a pretty respected group down there. And
he also was a pretty glossy candidate.
Yeah, he ran against a very weak candidate, but, you know, I'm focusing in right here. I'm reading that the majority of voters who said that the economy, Massachusetts economy, is
mm-hmm.
not so good or poor, that number, by the way, was 52%, they voted for Brown by a margin of 56-39.
That's amazing.
The voters who said the economy was good or fair supported Coakley, Martha Coakley,
right.
The AG, Attorney General there, 52-43. And this one kind of really slapped me in the face. Brown even won voters in the 20% of households in which someone had lost a job in the last year.
Wow.
50-45%. So I think, you know, the Democrats ought to take the results very seriously. And, I think there's a feeling here that Obama and the Democrats have done too little rather than attempting to do too much.
Well, even the liberal media, even your MSNBC folks there are all saying the same thing, and they're saying that he hasn't done enough, you know, with a majority in the Senate and a majority in the House. It didn't make any sense that none of this stuff didn't pass.
Yeah, and I don't look fine. Put it all at Obama's doorstep either. I think
A majority. I mean, the thing that screwed them up, I think, was this gray dog.
Blue dogs.
Blue dog Democrats. I mean, all of a sudden, 10 of them come up and decide they're going to be Republican. You know, become the whole Lieberman thing.
Right. And again, you don't want to draw too much from a single election.
Mm.
I'm not sure it was a referendum on Obama, as the Republicans like to say.
Do you think it could have been a referendum on Kennedy, the Kennedy seat, the whole Kennedy thing?
I just see this nation, certainly voters in the state of Massachusetts, and we'll see what happens in our elections here in Connecticut. I mean, I think voters and citizens are all over the place. I think that the economy isn't making any kind of significant growth, showing any kind of significant growth or recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I think
there's a real lack of leadership.
Well,
that's the problem. People are looking for a leader, and there isn't any. There isn't someone.
But of all the candidates, for instance, running for governor this year in Connecticut.
Well, and before we get to that, if you don't mind, I mean, it's
no.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was
looking for leaders.
Point, but
leaders.
You know, you can't. I mean, it's interesting. Obama came in obviously on this whole groundswell of change, and in his defense, and perhaps this is by inference a criticism of House and Senate Democrats, and then the DLC, because they haven't developed a strategy to counter the discipline with which the Republicans have fought Obama. I mean, from the get-go, they were the party of no.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worked. And, you know, I don't think that's good. I don't think it's right. But, their tactic of just opposing everything and has paid political dividends for them. When you look at polls and you look at popular opinion, people forget that there was this guy, George Bush, you know, who preceded Obama,
mm-hmm.
and his administration really drove this country into the ground. And but there's very, you know, Obama seems to be on this very short leash where he inherited a mess, and the Republicans were smart enough in some ways to say it's his problem, it's the Democrats' problem, and they're not giving us any solutions. And, you know, it's really easy to be the party of no. I think it has destructive consequences, but I think you're seeing, you know, the sort of the cynical dividends of that approach, which is more Republicans or like Scott Brown are winning elections. But, you know, it's no answer to the problems that afflict our nation and afflict our economy. So I could be totally all wet on this, but I just kind of see that going on, too. And, it's, you know, you can't put it all at Obama's doorstep or the Democrats' doorstep. What you can say is that they haven't figured out an adequate response to the party of no.
But I think in healthcare, he waffled.
Yep.
And he didn't show leadership right away.
No, again, I don't want to overstate any one piece of this poll in Massachusetts, but union members were very concerned about how this administration has handled healthcare reform.
Yeah, I think so far,
we negotiate this for our members.
Yeah.
You know, there's a strong school of thought that, you know, if you want to have good healthcare, you should join a union.
That's right.
And I think that the excise tax really became an issue of that troubled union members. It was an issue of concern. And the Obama administration Democratic leadership really erred in pushing that. I mean, again, it was, I want to emphasize, it was a tax on, essentially it was a tax on insurance companies, but it was something that would be passed along. It was viewed as something that would be passed along either in the form of a benefit cut or a premium increase. Employers would be left with no choice but to, you know, because they were going to have to pay an excise tax on
mm-hmm.
the plans, they would either cut benefits accordingly or proportionally or else raise premium costs. And that put a lot of union members over the edge in terms of those who were surveyed in this poll. So I guess I agree with you a lot.
Yeah, I just think it is not a good idea to give a benefit to just union members. I think it's a very, I don't think it's a good move at all. I mean, hopefully.
What it essentially was doing was penalizing union members and those who have high end plans.
That's right.
So, you know, and I think it's just the whole combination of things is really made for a topsy turvy environment out there.
I'm sure that a lot of people feel if they have a good plan, why support Obama's plan?
I'd be lying to you if I said that I didn't hear that. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine here in Farmington who's a teacher in the Farmington school system and, you know, who voted for Obama and was very concerned that the whatever health care plan emerged would actually undercut the plan that was negotiated here in town. And, you know, much as I tried to talk people off a ledge on that, I think that's clearly a concern.
Yeah.
And again, the excise tax really pushed a lot of people over the edge.
Sure it did. And I can understand why.
Yeah.
But let's move on to talk a little bit about what's happening right here in Connecticut in the governor's race. Well, we have a lot of people jumping into that race, huh?
I don't even think I can name them all anymore.
Yeah, but there's one.
Jim Eamon dropped out. I know that much.
Oh, he dropped out.
that guy we were talking about tonight, we saw tonight advertised. He's running.
Well, Ned Lamont.
Tom Foley.
Tom
Foley. Yeah, he seems to have some energy behind his campaign, or at least some money. He's advertising quite a bit.
Well, he has money. I mean, he's a very conservative Republican.
Is that what he is?
Yeah,
I would consider
voting for because he's not an ally of working people.
Because he was talking about creating jobs, a small business cap.
Oops. Okay. I've got to turn this around.
You know, they're on the platform saying state and municipal employees have, you know, the state and the municipalities can't afford the lucrative plans. And, you know, that really offends me. We negotiate sensible plans. Lila can attest to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this real rush to blame public service workers at the state and local government level, Board of Education level. We didn't cause the problems that have afflicted this economy that triggered this economic crisis. We did not cause them.
Well, those people get rewarded.
Right. And,
with huge bonuses.
How about
solutions, not blaming people. people like, say, Lila, who have decent benefits.
That's right.
Somewhat decent pay. I really resent that, and, you know, Foley and all the Republican candidates have clearly made it clear that they blame us for the problems that are going on. And right away.
Well, thanks for telling me that. I
got Foley's website, you know, go.
Yeah, he's talking about that. Huh?
Interestingly, another rich guy, as you guys just pointed out, had his press conference today, Ned Lamont. So.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting.
The
campaign finance system. He's not going to use the public financing option.
You know, we were the first radio show to ever interview Ned Lamont. We were the first radio
show. You guys, wow.
Yeah.
Foley on it. I'd be curious to see if he'd come on.
You think so?
Reach out.
People
seem to enjoy your program, and they recognize that you've got some, you have a lot of listeners out there, and I'd be curious to see if they would come on. But
So
you had Ned back when he was running.
Against Lieberman.
In 06, yeah.
Some people feel he's a different person. So.
He is. He was calling himself the entrepreneurial candidate.
Right.
You know, and I checked him out. He's got the typical. It's not like everybody can donate a library to Harvard, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know.
No, really.
and his great uncle, started the secular humanism movement in the United States.
I didn't know that.
Founder of it.
Which is kind of interesting because that's
atheism. You know, but secular humanism. So he's got a whole big.
Him on a number of occasions. Most recently.
Whole foundation on that.
Sal Luciano was speaking at a healthcare reform forum, and Ned was on the panel with him. And he's an interesting, smart guy. He's run a very tough race. When you run a U.S. Senate race, so he does have campaigning
experience.
He's been hardened by that.
And he has a lot of money to throw at this race.
That is an understatement.
Yeah, and in 06 he was worth $100 million. I don't know what, and that's his own personal fortune, not what he's.
And maybe it's scary. Foley is incredibly wealthy. You have Linda McMahon running for U.S. Senate.
Now that's a scary thought, don't you think?
It troubles me. I mean, I think.
You think she has a shot at that? Next to Blumenthal?
She was an executive.
I'm not even convinced she can beat Rob Simmons in the Republican primary, I guess.
Right.
But what concerns me is that the field of candidates seems to be limited to kind of the hacks like Simmons who have, been around and run before, or really extraordinarily wealthy novices who can kind of buy their way into the process, and I don't begrudge them their wealth. I worry about this system because.
Well, what did you think of this new? Your opinion of the Supreme Court decision where now corporations are.
I think it's a very troubling.
Isn't that horrible? Yeah, I mean, who was at the switch on that one?
Think about. And, the importance of politics and who gets to appoint Supreme Court justices. This is a product of the...
Yeah, well, Bush
appointment. Yeah, and, John Roberts is the Chief Justice. Samuel Alito got in before Bush left. And they and Scalia are tipping the balance for a number of decisions that generally anti-consumer, anti-worker, anti-citizen, and this is a great example. This is not great. This is a very illustrative of what's going on. They've essentially said corporations are people and shouldn't be limited. Well, that's not true. They're not people. They're, great wealthy institutions that can buy a lot of influence and buy a lot of public policy outcomes that you and I could never dream of doing. So it's a troubling, scary decision.
I don't like that, Roberts at all.
All it did is uncover the veil.
Yeah.
That's all it did. Because it made them naked to the daylight.
Yeah, in my naive, dream world, they just want to take all the money out of the system.
That's it. They just want to drain it and
playing field and give us a shot. And I think what's troubling is that to run for office, you got to be rich. You got to have a lot of money and a lot of connections.
You know what's troubling to me is I was talking to a friend the other day in the town where I work, and I said, I asked her, what's so-and-so doing? He was the kid that went to our local school and then graduated from high school, graduated from college. She said, oh, well, he's home. He's unemployed. I said, oh, how's his sister doing? Oh, she can't find a job either. And how is this other kid that I knew doing? No, he's home, too. He doesn't have a job either. These are all college graduates.
Wow.
They can't find jobs. They're unemployed. One is working at the local factory. Someone else is doing part-time work someplace else. And all kids with, you know, went off to college with pretty good prospects.
Right.
Now, that's pretty sad.
And, you know, we may have talked about this a few months ago. You know, the AFL-CIO did a survey on Labor Day about young workers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a bleak picture. College graduates can't find meaningful, decent-paying employment. And that's a, you know, that's a real problem. And, you know, the Republicans might be crowing about their victories now, but it's really a problem for everybody.
There's an article, it was from Ross' story tonight. We were going to read it tonight, I think. But it was about inner-city schools in Detroit.
Yep.
High schools.
Yep.
Have a class on working in Walmart. All right. And not only do they have a class on working for Walmart, they have over 50% unemployment on the inner cities.
Wow.
That's right. That's right. And
well,
Detroit, the city of Detroit.
What they were doing in their class was teaching the inner city kids how to deal with the separate culture of the suburbs, because that's where the Walmarts are located. So how to act with those people and how to talk to them, so they could get entry-level jobs.
In Walmart.
In Walmart.
And which is just, you know, it's simply not sustainable employment.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is what
they're... But they're so desperate, they took that.
But instead of training a kid to, do something, because better than that, they're encouraging them all to work for Walmart.
And again, this is, I think, that, you know, this is the backlash that the, you know, again, the majority party, which at this time happens to be the Democrats, has to deal with. There are not good jobs being created. We have this phenomenon that will be called a jobless recovery. And I just, you worry about, you know, not just ourselves, but our children and our grandchildren, but the fact is that kids are going to college, getting decent educations, and the prospects are very grim.
We had a lady on a couple weeks ago. It was called
Bright Futures Jobs.com.
Yeah. And she was a lobbyist for employment. She was a lobbyist for jobs.
Mm-hmm. Very smart lady.
And it's called Bright Futures. .com, I think, brightfuturejobs.com. And her name was Donna Conroy. And she was excellent, actually. She spoke about the creation of jobs. She lobbies Washington for the creation of jobs. And one of the primary problems that she has is these H-1 visas, I think they're called H-1 visas?
Yes.
That are allowing technology companies are demanding that they expand the H-1 visa program, all right, so that they can bring in more technical people from India and the other countries, rather than use
American workers
who are qualified, all right.
And what they're doing is they're flooding the media saying that American workers aren't qualified, which isn't true.
And going to Congress, lobbying Congress and saying that they need this because they don't have enough qualified people in the United States.
And it's such bunk.
It is. And this is what
And they're getting away with it.
Her whole organization is against this and trying to and lobbying Congress for the creation of jobs through different programs and different mediums, but specifically to try to stop the H-1 visas program. Because it's the corporations are running rampant with it, and
technology companies,
yeah.
But it doesn't stop there. They're even trying to do it with teachers.
But it's they're doing it with teachers as well, and they're bringing them in. But what's worse, it's almost like borders on human trafficking, because what's happening is they're bringing them in legally through the H-1.
visa, and then what they're doing is when they no longer need them, they abandon them, they leave them, they fire them, you know, or lay them off. But they're supposed to send them, bring them back to their country, but they don't do it.
They just leave them.
They just leave them here, so they're kind of like wandering around, you know, with no jobs. All right.
You know, we wonder why, you know, the economy is struggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we should say why people are struggling. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Totally crazy.
You know,
that's
what's troubling, and that's a function of a really bad, really destructive public policy like now, like other trade agreements, where, you know, the chase is for finding, the goal is to find the cheapest labor possible, no matter what the moral and financial cost to this country. And you have the able-bodied people who can't find gainful employment, and that's devastating.
Well, big business is just drooling over Haiti. They can hardly wait to send slave shops and sweatshops down there.
Yeah, I'm with you guys on this. It's just... that's why I can never, you know, say the Clinton presidency was such a good thing.
Because
that was NAFTA. That's what I'll
remember. That was horrible, yeah.
Well, I was reading, and I've forgotten which site it was, that they were comparing the opportunities in Haiti they'd be able to compete with China now. They could pay people 50 cents an hour.
And, you know, that... Where are we headed as a nation?
I mean, it just made me sick.
People can't survive on that kind of money. And don't we want to have an economy that's virtuous, where people can buy things, and, you know, buy homes and cars? And
well, that's the whole thing, Larry. What happens if you can't, if you can't buy anything,
right,
then who gets rich? I mean, you know, there's no capitalism anymore.
Well, what they're doing is killing the goose.
I think so. Again, that's why, you know, there's so much vitriol aimed at public employees, and it's neither fair nor accurate. Nor
you're right there, yeah. No, that's true.
You know, in addition to providing the services, who else is, you know, able to participate in the economy?
Hmm.
Everybody should be able to participate in this economy, and I do worry about that. Who's going to be left?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really scary for a lot of people.
Yep.
They're very, very scary. I mean... I'm fortunate. I belong to a union, so I have good health care, and that's a wonderful, wonderful benefit.
Well, you know, and I appreciate that you understand that, and I think, you know, maybe that's the positive note. There are answers out there. Maybe they're not the most popular, but I think that we have to recommit ourselves to organizing more workers and then trying to bring the union message, because that's one of the things that's going to... give people a ticket to the middle class.
That's absolutely right.
Totally on that. So.
And I think that I guess we have to do more with the membership drive.
Yep.
That this is an important time when you can get, this is an opportunity for unions to grow right now, I think.
I think so, and if we don't do it now, then I don't know, you know, when.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is a time when you can emphasize the benefits of belonging to a union,
right,
and maybe increase our membership.
Right, exactly.
And we'll have more strength.
Oh, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, that's really important. I think that's the way to go.
All right.
I agree with you 100%.
I knew you would, Larry.
I'm biased in that respect.
Well, Larry, we appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was fun.
This
was lively. I enjoyed it, and look forward to talking with both of you very soon.
Yeah, we will.
Okay, Larry.
Thanks.
Good night.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
That was Larry Dorman, the Aspen Union.
You need to give a station ID, and then...
All right. And that was Larry Dorman. Yeah, we had a great talk with him. Hope you got something out of that. Let's see, we have about 1 minute left here, and I guess we'll just run it down. Want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Join me tomorrow night when I'm not sure if I'll continue the tarot readings or not. I may. That might happen tomorrow. If not, I'll be reading some mystical
would be in the spiritual world of that level. So I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Friday night we have George Dixon. You can join us then on Friday night as well. So good night.